morning, everyone. As you appreciate, there appears to be a problem. Okay? A small glitch, technical glitch. And I thought that what we could do is just check what it is that has to be done. For example, there are minutes, are there not? So it may be possible. We've got, at the moment, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and this is why I wanted someone from the EFF just to join us. They're on the same floor, are they not? My intention, if we can make that start, to say that we could adopt, we may not be able to adopt the agenda at the moment, but at least we can move on to get the apologies and then begin to start on the minutes before one other person arrives. Because currently we've got two apologies. I'm not sure where the Honourable MacPherson is, Honourable Hill Lewis, because he sent me email to say be here at 9:30. It's 9:30.
No, Chair, there must have been an error. He's in Hong Kong. So it's going to be difficult for him to make it here.
Was that earlier, not this particular meeting?
It must have been last week, yeah.
Right. Okay, because he said that he would be able to attend at 9:30 because of his flights. Okay, that was what I'm referring to. The other one is the Honourable Mantash. There's been a flight problem there, and I'm not sure of the exact nature of it, but one flight was delayed and people put onto other flights, as it were. So she is only going to be here at 10 o'clock, that we already know. So she is coming. So we have those two then. The Honourable Eersterhuizen was also going to be here this morning, and we will ascertain what the problem is there. The Honourable Advocate Alberts has put in an apology. He is deployed to party work. So that's the only one that I'm aware of who is absolutely not going to be here. Does that Hong Kong arrangement, Honourable Hill Lewis, refer to the long leave?
Yes.
Okay, then I have that. But it's going to be useful, and this is for all members, just as a matter of fact. When those apologies are put in, we welcome the early nature of them, but it is quite useful just at the time that it happens to do a little reminder. So it's not that we don't have it recorded somewhere, all right, but that doesn't apply to him only, but to all members. Fine. So that's as soon as Mr. Hermans returns. I hope he's not just outside, is he? We can proceed. I can't proceed without a committee secretary. All right. We now officially open the meeting, and we can't adopt the agenda because we don't have sufficient people here. We're just waiting for that. We can check the apologies. I've already given them the apologies because both Mr. Eersterhuizen contacted me as well as Advocate Alberts, and I assume you've got that. And the Honourable Mantash, there was some flight change there, flight, and she will be here at 10. The apology that Mr. MacPherson put in, the Honourable MacPherson, applies to from today. He's away for some special leave outside the country. Okay, so that takes care of the apologies. Right, we may adopt the agenda according to these new rules for the purposes of this meeting. We are going to remind you, we need to add one thing, probably at 11:45, the delegation from the UK Parliament. I understand it's the House of Commons, and that's it, is it? Will be here. This arrangement was made from international relations in terms of the Speaker's office, and they will be here in M514, that's right here, to engage with the committee, all right, until 12:30, 12:45. We can't change the time. The other thing that we are adding here will be the colloquium, a third draft to take home with you, and we would hope that from there you will put forward all of your recommendations and the conclusions during the constituency break. On that note, can we please look at the minutes, even though we can't pass them at the moment? I thought you had. You had your hand up. Okay. Yeah. Honourable Williams. Yeah. Seconded by Honourable Mkongi. Can we turn to the minutes of the 6th? Page 1. Where are the, where's the register? Is it all there? Right. Page 2. Page 2.2, the adoption, 0.3, 0.4. Can I just check something with you, Mr. Hermans? Are we, who did these minutes? No, okay. It's one of a small point, but it's not going to affect our adoption. We just use bullets then when we're taking those four. I know why you did it, but there we are. Page 2. Page 3. Page 4. And the actual register is in order, I take it. Thank you. On that note, please, can we have someone to propose? No, we can't. We need the quorum, don't we, to do that? Fine. We'll set these aside for the moment till we can adopt. Wednesday, September, 14th September. The agenda, everyone present, that was a lot of you then, page 1. Mr. Hermans, who prepared the minutes? Oh, that's fine. Page 2. LOAs, committee business, briefing, page 3, quite a few resolutions, NRCS submits an action plan, etc., on how it's going to address the audit findings, NRCS submits a status report, ETI entities, all of them, should address action plans.
Sorry,
should submit.
What, 13,
14. I'm looking at page 3.6. I said there are quite a lot of resolutions, and I think it's important we take note of that, because this is what we're going to have to follow up. Yes, Honourable Williams.
Chairperson, I believe in that meeting we also resolved that we would get the performance contracts for all of the CEOs, for all of the entities, and it's not here in the resolutions.
Resolutions, please can we process correspondence that is required? And that correspondence, I think, in this instance, should go to the CEOs to do exactly what we have said. Secondly, to go to the DG of Trade and Industry, as well as the Minister, so that we processed all of them. An extra letter will be sent to the NRCS with respect to the Auditor General's findings. And when is the action plan going to be submitted by the deadline? We haven't taken a decision because we've got it. Yes, but we in future we would then just note we have received these. Have they been distributed? Have you received them? No. That'll be distributed today. Thank you. The next set of minutes, which we have already been through, Advocate Albert, Honourable Albert, is the 6th, but we didn't have a quorum. On page 1, we've done it. So the same technicalities will simply be addressed with respect to putting things a little bit lower. All right? And I take it that the schedule was correct because there was no one raising it. Can we please have somebody who was present to propose adoption? Honourable, yes, the 6th of September, Honourable Kornoff, seconded by the Honourable Hill Lewis. Right. On that note, then, we have a quorum, and we are in a position now to move with the engagement with Companies and Intellectual Property Commission, I see it was scheduled for 9:40 and we're running about 10 minutes late. But we do have with us members of the team, but I just want to get the register for SARS to be ensure that I am correct. At the committee's request, we invited SARS. Do you remember the request that you had? So we have here the South African Revenue Services, and we're very pleased to welcome Mr. Kingham. Thank you. I was getting him confused with his late dad and wondered how he got so young. He's the Group Executive Relationship Management. Thank you. I hope you follow in your father's exemplary service. Mr. Murray, Group Executive Tax Compliance, thank you very much. And of course, there is also from SARS, no, we've got them, we've mentioned them. We have our old friend here, the Acting Commissioner for CIPC, Companies and Intellectual Property Commission, Advocate Rory Foller. Thank you very much. And I see you feeling very comfortable there with SARS.
Yes, I'm very well.
Okay, that's useful. That's useful. Is everyone in compliance with their tax? I'm looking at all of you. I'd hate anyone to feel uncomfortable.
That doesn't mean we get on well with it, though.
Okay. No, you're quite right.
We get on well with it.
Now, you're quite right. I must say, ever since I stopped getting a little bit of money back,
yes,
my relationship has thinned. But anyway, thank you very much, and Ms. Naidu. And then with us, Mr. Medema should have been here. He's busy in Pretoria processing certain visas. But Mr. Hermans, who was ill yesterday, kindly stepped in. Thank you very much, Mr. Hermans, and we also have Ms. Madalani. I'm not going to delay you any further. I would certainly like Mr. Kingham, if that's how you're going to start, and it'll be over to you to indicate to us if we also would want, I'm sure you'd let us know if we need to include yourself then. Is it Mr. Fabian, Mr. Murray? I'm sure you will want to make a special input, is that right? I don't know, I'm looking at both of you. Or are you going to do it in one input?
We will probably mix and go through the thing and be open for questions and engagement as we go.
All right, thank you.
Would you like us to? Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you very much to the committee that we could be here today. I think Advocate Fuller has indicated that we do get on, and it's not just saying that. We have had a very good relationship over a number of years in terms of our engagement. There's obviously always room for improvement and room to grow, and I think that is what we intend to do. I'm going to probably run through parts of the presentation, and I'm not going to dwell on certain aspects, but just to highlight various aspects of our engagement, and Mr. Murray will fill in as and when need be in terms of the matter, but we'll run through it and see how we go through it, but please stop us if there are any questions. The brief given to us related more to tax clearances and the registration of businesses, and I need to just up front maybe say, Madam Chair, that you cannot get a tax clearance prior to a business being registered, so the one has to start and only thereafter can a company be registered. So we need a legal entity in order to get a tax number, and once you get a tax number, you can get a tax clearance, obviously, if you are compliant. And I think it's important, those steps. There have been talks over the years, but I don't want to go into that. Well, should directors not be compliant? There's many challenges with that, and in terms of piercing the corporate veil and understanding whether the directors are compliant. I'm not going to be addressing that. But just if we may run through the presentation, and I'm going to really run through it so we maximize our time in terms of engagement and just understanding if there are any questions. We're going to do an overview, information exchange and automatic tax registration that has been on the process for a couple of years already, a network interface, deregistration interface, and that's a manual interface today. We don't have beyond that, and tax compliance checks. I may just indicate that we have in the past explored the possibility of having joint services, for instance, having the self-service kiosks at our offices. That has not developed at this point in time, and we have not explored that much further in terms of our engagement. We can speak a bit to that. Just very, very importantly, the strategic collaboration, and obviously there are a number of entities that lead to the registration of a taxpayer. And the most important one is probably in terms of us is the Department of Home Affairs, where we talk of the population register, and obviously that can lead to a person being registered. And I am, unfortunately, in the screen in front of you, it's being cut off, the one behind you, Madam Chair, but just in terms of the left, obviously the CIPC companies, that is one aspect of our integration. And then very importantly, on the other side is the Master of the High Court in respect of trust. So those are the three key drivers in terms of registration of entities. And obviously it's important that we interface because that reduces the risk of fraud. So people are not portraying an entity that is not registered with the CIPC as being registered, etc. So historically, if I may just touch on this, people used to come to us and submit a form, and I'll just put it on the table, IT77C, it was a manual form, and you would have to represent that the company is registered. And we even had people fraudulently representing that this entity does exist with the CIPC. That led to us starting a process, a journey with the CIPC, and a very good journey. Obviously, there's always bumps in any journey like this. But today, the interface is live and it's active. And literally within seconds, a tax number for companies is issued to CIPC, and the company documents that CIPC gives to the client then includes the tax number for the entity. Now, we do not have a similar thing, obviously, for individuals, because not every individual has to be registered. And we are exploring with the Master of the High Court an engagement in terms of trusts. There are a number of concerns there. We obviously also have engagements with other third parties, and in terms of Mr. Murray's area where we do a lot of risk processing, etc., third-party data service providers such as banks, many the employers, and there's a whole host of them that provide data to us. And on the other side, obviously, the providers of data from government departments is some aspect that we're always wanting to explore. The key thing is to know our taxpayer. Is this taxpayer legitimate? Has this taxpayer really exist, that it's not a fiction, that somebody is trying to defraud us? We need to note that for income tax purposes, before we get to VAT, for income tax purposes, a person can't artificially generate a refund. I'm now talking a company, where that can be utilized for fraudulent purposes. So that's why the registration is very simple for a company. We get the data from the company's office, we put it through our systems, and I'm not even aware of one single rejection, Fabian, but to the extent 100% of all companies being registered at CIPC are registered for income tax purposes. So it's just a snapshot. We do have a way to go in terms of trusts, and very importantly also, the issue is we do not automatically issue a VAT registration number. Now, I know some members have raised a concern with regards to VAT registrations taking a long time. The fact of the matter is this is an area of great risk for SARS, and where people can claim inputs which may be fictitious, and we have to be very circumspect. We must remember that a entity is obliged to register for VAT if they have a turnover above $1 million, but there is a voluntary registration if your turnover is expected to exceed $50,000 within a year. Now, the challenge that we have is mostly in the voluntary side of things. The mandatory is fine. It's above a million, it's a bit more easy to prove. There are obviously risks as well, but they're different. But in the voluntary space, people may be seeking simply to gain a refund artificially, which is an area of deep concern to us. Just moving on then, and that's obviously the strategic collaboration, and we have a collaboration with all those three entities. We believe it will add to improved taxation, improved service, because very importantly, you can now register, once you've got your tax number, you can go and register on e-filing, and then it opens up other things that one can do. And e-filing is our electronic commerce channel. Maybe just touching on the objectives of the information exchanges, obviously to provide an integrated service between CIPC and SARS, and I think that's very self-explanatory, reduce administrative burden, and that is critical. We need to reduce the cost of compliance. SARS recognizes this, that we do need to reduce the cost of compliance to business. Removal of duplication for companies. We did in history have duplication of registrations prior to the rollout of the interface. There's one or two areas we're still working on in terms of conversion of closed corporations, as they were called, to companies, where we have a slight challenge currently, but we're working in terms of that. Most importantly, though, I think the improving of data quality by receiving data from CIPC is critical. So there's no chance in terms of capturing incorrectly, that they spell my surname incorrectly or the company's name, etc. That there's one channel for the capturing, which is CIPC, and then it comes through to us. And obviously, to utilize the data from the CIPC to assist internal SARS data matching migration and quality improvement projects, as well as sharing data with CIPC to improve their data quality. Very importantly, Madam Chair, a year or so ago, the Minister of Finance published a regulation which allows us, because we are bound by confidentiality, to share data with the CIPC. And this is demographic data. We do not, we are permitted, therefore, to share data with them, but we are not allowed currently to share financial data, and I'll get into that in a few minutes, and we can take it from there. If I may move on, and this is the area of sharing of financial data, and this is an area where we have not fully, we've started the journey, we haven't completed the journey. The CIPC has got a need for the annual financial statements in some form or other for their processes. We get those financial statements in terms of our processes. We've got different rules, so small business doesn't have to provide financial statements, and there's various categorizations of business, and there's certain categories that do need to attach a set of financials to the data set. Now, the challenge legally is that we are not allowed to provide that data to CIPC. We therefore, in the company tax return, have an indicator where the company can select that we can share the data. And the last time I checked, we were up at about 70% of companies indicating that they are prepared that we can share the annual financial statement data. There are certain things we need to check on this, and this is work in progress. But it is an area we want to continue to develop and utilize the interface that already exists between us and the CIPC. And then obviously the demographic data such as addresses. I think one of the challenges which CIPC has had in the past is keeping up to date with where the company moves, and we obviously want to share that data with them. I'm not going to deal with this slide if you don't mind, but it's there for your information, and just highlighting various aspects of data and information utilization, I'm not going to touch on that slide today, but it is there for your information. I have spoken through some of the facts here. This is just with regards to the interface between us and the CIPC. It was built in September 2014, and it's been working successfully since then. And it uses what we call Connect Direct technology. It's a secure interface with no data loss between. So there's checks and balances in the data flow to ensure that there is no data loss in terms of the interface. I'm not going to deal with that slide any further at that point. One of the areas, Madam Chair, that we do face a challenge is deregistration of companies. As you are aware, the CIPC has got a process in place that if companies do not fulfill their annual obligations, there's a deregistration that takes place. Recognizing the challenge with this, and maybe just to highlight what is the challenge to SARS, the key aspect is that if CIPC deregisters Mark King and Pty Limited, and Mark King is owing 5 million rand to SARS, it makes it very difficult to go and chase up a non-entity for tax. We'd have to have it reinstated.
Yeah.
And that is done through a court order, normally, that we'd have to follow. Now, that doesn't work. So our process currently is a manual interface where data is provided to us by CIPC. We run that against our databases, and we indicate back to CIPC the entities that we do not want to have registered. It is one of the areas, Madam Chair, that we do believe we need to advance and have an automatic process in this regard. It's something that we haven't got to because of other priorities, but it is something that is still on our agenda to do at some point in time in the future. But we have covered the risk in terms of this by having a collaborative approach with the CIPC where they come to us and we provide the data to us. Tax compliance, and it's re-emphasizing something we said earlier, that no tax compliance can be done prior to the registration of the company. I think that's self-explanatory, and I don't need to go into it. If there are questions, Madam Chair, later on that, we can deal with that. Tax compliance, and maybe just to brief the committee as to where we are. Historically, the Minister of Finance, I think it was in the early 2000s, introduced the process of what we call tax compliance. And it required, in order to do business with SARS, that a tax clearance certificate would be issued and provided with all tenders, for example. The challenge that we had with tax clearance certificates was that they were produced and printed by the SARS offices, and just out of interest, more than 1.2 million people had to visit our branches just to collect clearances in a year. The paper printed version could be reproduced if you know Photoshop at all, and could be reproduced and defrauded, and we have much fraud being committed with people saying they're compliant where actually they are not compliant, and the certificates being artificially produced. We therefore, in the course of the last year, and on the 18th of April to be exact, we rolled out a new system which is provided for in the Tax Administration Act, where we brought in what we call a tax compliance status. And there are a few key issues that we need to highlight there. But where previously the certificate was a compliance over a period of 12 months, the tax compliance status now is an ongoing status, because I can at every single month, so on the 7th of the month, pay as you earn is due. If it's not paid on the 8th, I'm non-compliant. But previously, the certificate was issued for a full year. We've therefore brought in the basis that a certificate can be checked at all aspects of a tender provided. So not only at the awarding of a tender, but also at payment. Am I still compliant? Because we find that there are companies who simply get the TCC and then just ignore us for another year, then get their figures back up to date, etc., resubmit returns and all that they have to do, make payments, and then they default again once they get the TCC. This no longer happens. There's a tax compliance status that is validated and can be validated every single day. I'm not going into all the aspects of the benefits of it, but the key thing is that it is far less onerous on the taxpayer, and I'll just say why. And that is, number one, it can be applied for online on e-filing. And secondly, I can now print it at my own machine. Now, people may ask, well, if I can print it, can't I just defraud that? The fact is that the tax compliance status is validated actually through you going on your own e-filing and punching in the compliance certificate number, and it comes back and it tells the entity that's checking, am I compliant or not compliant? So tax compliance status has changed radically in the last year, 18th of April exactly from this year. We rolled it out. We are also, in terms of tax compliance status out of interest, providing data to the National Treasury, the Central Supplier Database, where that database is updated every day
with regards to the compliance status of people on the central supply database, which is run by the chief procurement officer. So just that's just some information for the committee, Madam Chair. I just thought it would be useful for you to have. I don't know, if Mr. Murray, if there's anything else from your point of view you'd like to add in terms of this, but that is it from our side, and we open for questions, Madam Chair.
All right, Mr. Murray, do you have anything to add?
I think my colleague has covered everything. I just want to perhaps just emphasize on the tax clearance certificate that we have. I think one of the concerns that we had in the past was the cumbersome process that was in place, because as a taxpayer, you needed to come into our branch twice, once to register for a TCC, and then when the TCC was ready, you needed to come in to physically come fetch the certificate. So with the new process that's in place, it's eased the burden on taxpayers, and the authenticity associated with that has substantially being enhanced. And the fact that it is real time, I think that is significant. Because you know, it's one thing being compliant today and a month later that you default on it. So the system that we have in place today ensures that it is real time, and it interfaces with National Treasury, so it's a very powerful system. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Murray. I think it's useful for us to, raise our questions now and make comments. And, of course, that doesn't mean we cannot come back to SARS after SIPC has addressed us. So let us stick to perhaps 3 to 4 minutes max. And I see by show of hands, Honourable Alberts, Honourable Kurinoff. So can I just have a look at the hands? Is that it for the moment? Thank you. Over to you then, Honourable Albert.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for the presentation. First of all, a question of clarification. DHA individuals, what does that stand for?
Madam Chair, that's Department of Home Affairs, and it's the Population Register.
Right, thank you very much. Just two questions, one on trusts, one on banks. What is the current law with regard to trusts? As you get the information from the master, do you check inside what's going on inside the trusts? And I think that the current law states that when a trust is actually just a duplicate of the individual, the trust can be disregarded. If you could just sort of give us more information on that part of the law as it developed, and then lastly, on the banking issue, I understand that the Amending Act on the Financial Intelligence Center Act is now with the President, which will allow exposure of information with regards to prominent persons or public prominent persons, if I put it that way, which will include obviously people like us sitting here and also people who run the country and various other departments. Would that help you a lot to also ascertain what's going on in people's banking accounts, especially with people who are supposed to actually set an example for the rest of the country? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Honourable Alberts. Honourable Kurinoff.
Thank you, Chairperson. Just one question on what SARS have said the problem they've had when SIPC is deregistering companies and there is still tax owed. I just want to be clear. Will you fix that in future, or is it fixed already?
Thank you, Honourable Kurinoff. Are there any other questions or comments at this stage? I have a couple myself, and that is when we, on your slide, the overview, when you were doing the overview itself, Mr. Kingham, you spoke about, companies and trusts, and that's it. And I wondered, I know that co-ops would come under CRPC, but I was wondering where this entity called a community benefit organization, and it gets this exemption from trust, but still have to get an exemption, you need to have gone through, if you know what I mean. Now, where do you get such information from? If we're, and some of the NGOs are CBOs, etc. That's that particular one there. The other thing as well is the question which you raised yourself around the deregistration issue. Now, I was just trying to get a handle on this myself. At one point you said that currently the information, or at least I think you said this, that you get from SIPC is manual. Okay, I'm making sure. Now, so that being the case, it's manual information, then you need to be, it needs to be recorded manually. We are going to deregister X, Y, Z. At which point does the relationship which you have developed, the SIPC and SARS, facilitate SARS saying, hang on, you can't just do that right now. You know, these people owe us a fortune. And is it then on that basis, even though technically the company should be deregistered now, that you put a little moratorium, you flag it, not to be deregistered. And it is actually noted so that no one can override it until such time as SARS returns with proof that they have dealt with this matter. Do you follow? Okay. So I just want to get a clarity then. The other issue is around, you know, the cost of compliance. This issue came up with co-ops, if you recall. And how do we deal with this, reduce the cost? Maybe we won't get these special auditors to do it. Someone else can do the auditing of co-ops. And we put a cap on the figure that your co-op would have to, the profits or the revenue that it gets. Now, on that cost, what are we talking about per se? That you say, look, we do understand that there is this challenge, particularly if a company is genuinely on the point of going under and is already in, what do they call this, business distress or something? Rescue. Well, they are distressed, aren't they? Yeah, rescued because of their distress. Okay. If you could address that one. The other one is the issue around trusts. At one point, I was under the impression we had such an aversion to trust, that is Treasury, that there weren't going to be any trusts, except for children, you know, who the education need to be dealt with because a parent had died or the state introduced, and that there are very few trusts now around. That you can't, I can't go and buy my house and say, you know, this house is in a trust. The trust is simply managed by Joan Phipps. I don't own it. The trust owns. And how does the tax work with that kind of trust arrangement? Because I was under the impression you were trying to do away with that loophole with respect to trusts themselves. So thank you very much.
Oh, mouthful of questions there. Maybe just to touch on, let's deal, if I may, with trusts. Just to understand trusts in the broader context. National Treasury, as you're aware, has been engaged on trusts, and there are various position papers that are in process with regards to trusts. But as we sit here today, there is nothing preventing a house being registered in a trust, put into a trust, or other trading going into a trust. There's nothing preventing that from happening. And I think it's very important that we note that. So today, a trust has got the benefit that it can vest certain of its income to other entities or individuals. So you can move the taxing through to other entities. And that is something that is busy being looked at. But as we sit here today, trusts are utilized. So there's two types of trusts, inter vivos trusts, as we know, and we have the so-called will trusts. Now, I think we all understand the will trust, and there's a requirement for that to be protected in terms of the beneficiaries to be protected going forward. The interesting question that Mr. Elvis raised, the issue of the trust of having really being a sham, I think, for want of a better word, is something that is being raised from time to time. It's not something that we've seen much of, that you say, well, the trust is actually not there. We simply look, does the Master of the High Court today, has it been registered with the Master of the High Court? We then register it for tax. And in terms of our annual gazette that we issue, they are required to submit a tax return, just like a company. Unfortunately, there is a huge non-compliance in this area, and it's one of the areas that we are addressing internally. But the issue of a trust really being the person is that there's various views about that out there. I'm not the expert on trust. Some of my legal colleagues in our legal counsel have a far better grip on that. But it's not something that we come across on a daily basis. Moving on to the issue also raised by Mr. Alberts with regards to the FIC and the interest, just very importantly, Madam Chair, we get regular data twice a year, in fact, and currently the financial institutions are submitting. We get data of all debits and credits into all bank accounts, as well as the interest flows into all bank accounts. We're getting that data. And that is part of the information that Mr. Murray and his team utilize in determining risk in terms of the submission of tax returns. So that data is already with us. I think it just happens every 6 months. The FIC works slightly differently, that if there's a suspicious activity report, that it would be then reported to them as and when it happens. There's certain obligations. Now, I'm not here to speak about the FIC. All I can assure you is that we are getting data already twice a year from all the banks. I don't know, Fabian, how many bank accounts we're getting, but it's millions. Millions and millions of bank accounts. We get all the RA contributions. We get all the medical aid contributions. There's huge amounts of data that flow. And its predominant purpose is to determine that each of us and other entities are making an accurate declaration in terms of their tax returns. It also obviously helps us if we suddenly see a huge amount coming into a bank account and there's no wherewithal for that amount, it could flag risk. Not necessarily, but it could. And those are things that we have in place. And I'm going to jump around if you don't mind, Madam Chair. The issue of the deregistration, I do want to flag this as it's an electronic manual process. Now, what do I mean by that? There's a data set that is provided to us electronically. There is no recapturing of it. It's an electronic data set that we then compare electronically and we feedback electronically. It just does not happen in an automated fashion like the registration where there's no hands involved. This requires a hand to be involved. In fact, I'm involved in that. And one of Advocate Paula's team sends us the data. We then analyze and send it back. We are of the view that this should be automated fully, that if there's a non-compliance on their side, we should know about it electronically. I just cannot give any commitment at this point in time as to when that would happen. That has to be prioritized in terms of our general priorities, and there are a huge number of priorities out there. Just with regards to the issue of what you're calling community benefit entities, we call them public benefit organizations. The one gap in terms of the slide that is in front of you is within the non-profit sector, we get what we call an association of persons. It's an entity it is a legal entity because it's established by a constitution, but it has not got a registration authority like a company has, like a trust has.
I just mentioned
that again. Okay, very importantly, these entities which are associations of persons, so for instance in the religious area or within a number of charities, they're established in terms of a constitution. They are formed. We do get some that are registered as an NPC, non-profit companies at CIPC, but now I'm talking of the ones which are formed in terms of a normal constitution. There is no registration authority for them. So we, in terms of SARS's processes, it is dealt with on an application basis. So you'll find that your religious entities or your charities, many clubs, and we can go on, that the list is endless, are formed through a constitution, and they submit their documents to us to register for tax and to apply for a tax exemption, which we do grant certain tax exemptions, and there's certain other benefits where donations are tax deductible, for instance, depending on the nature of those businesses. So obviously that is something that is always a challenge, but we're not unique in the world in that regard, where there's no registration authority for these entities. If we were to force them to go CIPC, I think the cost, we get people from rural areas who are doing a good little charity, they're providing orphan care to a few orphans. You don't want to put the burden of registering with the CIPC on them, and we are not in that. We must find better ways to help them. We do. We've got dedicated service channels for them, etc. Then just lastly, and I'd like my colleague and maybe Advocate Fuller to come in terms of the cost of compliance, if there's anything to add. The issue of the cost of compliance, we have tried to reduce it, and very much this interface has reduced the need. We have seen the cost to register a company come down hugely over the last few years. I mean, you can go to your bank today, and I think for a few hundred rand, register a company, where previously you'd have to go through some agent who would charge you 2,500 or something like that. So really, it has simplified the process and reduced the cost. The peripheral costs, and people will often complain in terms of some of the costs with tax, but we have allowed, and many of our processes today, so once the company is registered, you can do the registration on e-filing for VAT, for pay as you earn, which is the deduction from employees of tax. You do not have to consult, for instance, with a tax practitioner to do these processes. Now, some people obviously feel more comforted by using practitioners, but it is possible today to do an end-to-end small business on your own, and the compliance is simplified hugely. It's when you get into the complex businesses and complex business structures that advice is needed, where the cost is increased. In terms of business rescue, I've got nothing further to say at this point. I don't know, Advocate Fuller, if you have.
I just want to add a few things. The one question you asked was the issue about what happens after SARS informs the CIPC regarding. We basically flag the entity, and we do not deregister it. We place a moratorium until SARS informs us otherwise that they are now tax compliant and their affairs have been put in order. But that is not an ideal. I think there's two ideals that need to be attached to that. The one is, I think Mr. Kingan has mentioned, is that we need to have we believe an electronic interface that deals with this thing in an automated fashion, and that's something that we're going to put together as one of our projects going forward. But the other thing is also what is being done from the DTI side, and the committee will know who are responsible for it, is that there are amendments that will be proposed to the Companies Act, and one of the amendments is that if there's outstanding monies to a regulatory authority like SARS, and we need to define that correctly also in terms of the law, then we will not go through a deregistration process until that has undergone scrutiny and until the compliance factor has been put in place. So that is something that we have proposed as part of an amendment to the Companies Act, and certainly something my colleague, Mr. Ramabulando, sitting behind me, who's responsible for those amendments, will certainly scrutinize and put through. I agree with Mr. King regarding the issue of the reduction of the burden, and there's many things that we do. I think that the collaboration between CIPC and SARS is built on two factors. One is certainly the reduction of the burden, so that people don't have to stand in queues any longer or make applications at various entities. But the other is also the issue of making sure that we tighten up on compliance. So if we have much scrutiny, and as we know, SARS has a lot of good search engines and business engines in the back end that do a lot of compliance and scrutiny, if we can piggyback on those, which we have been doing, then certainly we have data sets that are correct, and we certainly have verification and validations that are correct. So we have lots of eyes looking at the same set of data in the business world, and therefore we can ensure that there's a lot of integrity in the data that we hold. And that's certainly some of the benefits that this collaboration has brought to the table.
Taken a conversation.
Yeah, my apologies that I was out of the room.
Yeah.
I actually had a very simple question. If you could just give us an update on exactly the length of time that it takes at the moment to the, sorry, to the gentleman from SARS, in order to be VAT registered, and then the requirements around the, perhaps you can just explain this to us for clarity, the requirements around the 50,000 Rand that needs to be in your bank account, is that the requirement before you're issued with a SARS number? Well, I'll tell you how I've become aware of this. As you know, a couple of years ago, the committee followed up on the illegal agents, they call themselves agents, that were operating outside of the CIPC headquarters. Sometimes they call themselves runners. They were also offering SARS VAT registration as a service to the public. And they were saying that the way that they can do VAT registration on behalf of the public is that they actually do a 50,000 Rand EFT on the applicant's behalf so that they can get VAT registered. And I spoke to several of them in this regard, and they were charging about, I think at the time it was about 3,500 Rand or 4,500 Rand to get this done. So I just wanted to know where that 50,000 Rand EFT came into it. Is that what has to be in your bank account in order to get VAT registered, or is that the turnover requirement? What is that?
All right, if you would address that, Mr. King, on
thank
yourself,
you.
Ms. Honourable Montash. No, thank you.
Firstly, the 15,000 aspect is not a requirement in any law, but the 50,000 issue comes down to voluntary registration. You need to either have already 50,000 turnover in terms of the year, or there's a prospect that by the end of the year there will be 50,000. And that is what we're talking about here. The challenge that, I must be honest, what you've just referenced with regards to an EFT, so they're trying to fictitiously show that this business has got a 50,000 Rand turnover. In my view, that's fraud and misrepresentation. The issue here is that this is the area that people are abusing this to get on the VAT register, get to a point that they can start claiming input invoices, which can be legitimate, but the trouble is there are many of them that are not legitimate. So they create invoices, they fictitiously create invoices, and we find people, different companies using invoices, etc., for the same invoice. They just changed the name, etc. And these are the things we need to stop. Now, coming to the issue, Madam Chair, with regards to the time period of VAT registration, the challenge is this is one of our areas where there is fraud, as I've said already. So to commit to a certain period is always difficult. But generally speaking, there are some VAT registrations. Let's talk of a company that's well-established and it wants to establish a new branch registration for VAT. It happens in many cases instantaneously. So the person can do it on e-filing, submit the proof. We check certain things electronically in the background and VAT registration is given. The biggest challenge is when there is no history of this client. And we have a process. And generally speaking, it is resolved within 21 days. We do, in some cases, send out staff. In other words, we send out people to go see, does Mark King and Pty exist at the address that they say they're trading at? Is there a business premises? Are there offices that are legitimate, that is not just a sham? If I may share with you, there are many cases we land up at some empty piece of property or at somebody else's business. And there are many examples that I have that show that people are trying to create something out of nothing just to claim that benefit. So we do apply a lot of checks and balances. Where there is a lot of doubt, it may take longer than 21 days. And I accept that. But we have an obligation to the FISC to prevent that refunds flow out of the FISC illegitimately. We obviously want to smooth the way for legitimate business. And that is always the challenge because we have fraud in the process. But 21 days is our rule, as a rule, but there are many that are far quicker than that. There are some that are longer as well. And we do deal with with those, but the complaints that we're getting, and in my role, I have been involved in the complaints processes, they have dropped off. They were, at some, they peak at some points, but it's often dependent on fraud that we are picking up. But we try to do it as quickly as possible, especially because we know it helps business and to advance their business. They need to claim the refunds to get cash flow to advance their business further. And we want to help them as best possible in that regard.
Now, I must say you alerted me to something that came up in NRCS when we conducted an engagement with them. Members will remember they spoke about one of the challenges they faced was that when goods came in, and now you wanted to check on these goods because quite clearly there were some element of contravention in the goods, and you looked for this company XYZ to deal with this now, you found that it didn't exist. It was just a vacant plot or something. Do you remember that issue coming up? Because we're not supposed to deal with something and forget what about the crossover. Now, I'm asking this, and I'm looking at the director at the back from DTI. Mr. Desmond Ramabalana, is it? Bulana, yes. And I didn't recognize you because I didn't see your name immediately. Now, what is going to happen? I'd like you to take this up at the DTI area, and we're also going to take it up with NRCS, because it would appear as if there is this interface here. At the same time, there's the interface with CIPC. Advocate Fowler, you know, because then they could have asked you, is this registered? But just to learn after a lot of time wasted and how long was they were to make an inquiry. Here's company XYZ, we don't know, we can't get hold of them. Quick one to CIPC, CIPC said no, no, you know, it's not a registered company. Quick one to SARS, how long does it take for NRCS, if you like, assisted department or entity to get this information that may speed up their process. So the DTI, I want you to take this back to your division. Is it CCRD? Yes. Right. And Mr. Fowler, Advocate Fowler, what would be the, your response?
Yes, 100%, Chair. You know, we have so much collaborations and the movement of data between many entities, all the way through to, from municipalities to local government to national departments to various entities. So we provide the data to literally hundreds, if not thousands, of entities. We enter into MOUs with them, and we basically they have real-time access to our data. I can't be 100% sure if NRCS is one of them. I certainly will go back and check. And if not, I will make the recommendation that we will give them the data.
Thank you, Advocate Fowler. And SARS, Mr. Kingon, they went to you. You know what happens? It lands up in the port, some goods, and they're not going to be released because there's something wrong with these goods. They are not compliant one way or the other. Now we must get hold of this company, and at that point, you can't find the company. You've heard of this. Do you remember the NRCS? Now they're stuck, the NRCS. You follow?
I think it goes back to the aspect, and I agree with you, Madam Chair, is that, and the point I made earlier about many databases, many verifications will lead us to somewhere. So if they can check through us, and if they can check through SARS, because if it's such a large entity that they're importing, then I think they should have some tax affairs and addresses in place. So we can cross-reference them and check and provide the data to the NRCS, and maybe it can lead to some sort of investigation or finding on who the people they are.
Madam Chair, I think just very importantly, we need to understand the broader secrecy provisions as well. So there are secrecy provisions that may prevent. Now, I'm not aware of the specific incident, but we'd welcome the engagement, and I think that is the approach that we take. We take the approach that to the extent in law we can help, we will help. And our doors are always open to engage in terms of matters like this. But just bear in mind our secrecy provisions, please.
We'll raise this with the NRCS as well, and thank thank you, Advocate Fowler, for indicating that you'd be very happy to take this further yourself in this regard. We ourselves as a committee will take this forward. I think that's important. But just at this time, and before we engage with CIPC, I'm just checking, I think, to try and organize a tea break now is a little bit early. We can immediately start with yourself then, Advocate Fowler. But I'm going to ask SARS, remain where you are. I think you're happy where you sit. Am I right? Yeah. So stay where you are because there may be the need to do a little crossover. I hope there are no flights. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm caught somewhat by surprise. I'm here to back up SARS, but I will tell you what we've been doing. Much of the stuff that has been mentioned in the SARS presentation is exactly that. It's given a historic context to the relationship. It's giving a context to the collaboration going forward. And to a certain extent, it also gives a future view of what we want to do between the two entities. As we've said, we've had a good relationship to date, so much so that we used to meet very, very regularly, and I think something that we need to pick up once again and basically try and entrench it as part of what we do on a weekly basis. But I want to pick up on three points that I think is tangibles that I feel the relationship and the collaboration can take forward, and it's something that we will now, as two entities getting together, obviously project plan it and move it forward. The one is that we started a while ago, and the committee will be very familiar with the fact that the CIPC has something called self-service terminals, and our whole plan is to roll out these self-service terminals the length and breadth of the country. Now, we also have a mindset which is called a one-stop shop mindset, where we want to reduce the burden to business. So in our view, when a new entrepreneur and a new business starts off, there's three things besides once you do business and make money. There's three things they look for in terms of compliance. The first, they want to get registered, so that's a CIPC perspective, and it's something that we do, and it's something that we want to speed up and improve as we've been doing over a period of time. The next is that they go look for a bank account, and as you know, we've been doing a lot of work with the banks, and we've got all four banks on board. And the last aspect is they want to go and be tax compliant, so they apply for tax. And that is where our relationship with SARS comes in. As Mr. Kingan has said, we have this high-speed line since 2014. Some strange things happen. Sometimes people get registered for tax while the company is still being processed. So it just shows the effectiveness of the movement of data between the entities. It does not get lost. And basically, we have closed that loop. But what we want to do is, and coming back to the point of the reduction of the burden and also providing an inquiry service, is that we started discussing the issue of placing our self-service terminals in SARS offices. So a person will be able to go into a SARS office, be able to register for a company. The movement will then happen between the data, and if they want to apply for other tax products, because SARS have many, many tax products, they'll be able to be in a SARS office and be able to do an inquiry service there and then. I think the biggest burden is for small businesses is the up and down to offices, going in and making applications to various places or inquiring on information that they need in order for them to meet their compliance obligations or to be compliant in other areas. So if we're going to place them there, I recall probably about a year or a year and a half back, we actually had identified the offices, Mark, if you recall, that we want to place the self-service terminals in. One was in the Pretoria branch because it was a pilot project. One was in Soweto, and I just can't recall where the third one was. But we had identified three pilot offices that we were going to place the terminals in, and I think it's high time that we picked this up and basically provided that service. The second one is that, and this is a service that has been mentioned by our minister, I shouldn't say my minister, not only mine, it's also the committee's minister, that has been mentioned by our minister, Rob Davies, in my one-on-one with him, is that we also need to look at the issue of the use, what we would call the file once use many service. So when you look at the annual tax compliance obligations for companies, linked to the annual return of companies, we somehow must look at how we can make this one process. Because what happens in terms of the burden for business is that they have to go to SARS and lodge their annual compliance and annual returns, and they need to come to CIPC and lodge their annual returns. So what we started doing also about 18 months ago was looking at the data model and looking at the data sets. And I think Mark had put up a slide that shows exactly that. If there is a crossover between data sets, for instance, if the addresses are asked by CIPC and the addresses are asked by SARS, and the directors are asked by CIPC and asked by SARS, and the turnover is asked by PNC and there's SAS. You're getting the point. Why must people ask for do these things twice? They should be able to do them once and basically have the movement of data between the entities and basically able to reduce the burden as far as that is concerned. So the second project or a collaboration I think that we should explore, and we started exploring as far as the data sets are concerned, is the issue of a one filing of an annual return. It's the same document that goes to SARS, and it's the same document that goes to CIPC. Because, for example, if you look at financial information, in the Companies Act, we require annual financial statements with the filing of an annual return. SARS requires the same thing. They require annual financial statements at the filing of their annual returns. So it's the same thing. You know, it becomes a burden. So let's see how best we can get the entrepreneurs and the business people to file either at CIPC or SARS, and we just move the data between us instead of going and doing separate applications. So that's the second one. The third one, I think we've mentioned, and I think we had a bit of a discussion, was the issue about the interface of the deregistration process. As it currently stands now, is that we extract the information. I think we put on a CD, I think it is, or a hard drive, and it's very inefficient. And then we send it off to SARS. They run it against their database. They flag. They send it back to us. We then flag to say, do not deregister. It's just an inefficient service. So I think that we need to obviously automate it. We must look at electronic services as far as that is concerned, and basically see how best we can deal with deregistration of companies in a more efficient way between the two entities. There are other things that we are doing currently. I know that SARS has a problem with the issue of companies that go into business rescue and they're not informed. Similar thing with deregistrations, because many of these companies have tax obligations. So that's something also that we need to do, is inform SARS of business rescue companies so that they can flag them and basically deal with the compliance issues regarding outstanding tax and all the rest. Coming back to some of the other collaborations that we do with SARS that include other entities, the committee members might recall that we now have something called a Central Suppliers Database. I think Mark mentioned it briefly. It's a collaboration between CIPC, SARS, and under the auspices of National Treasury. I think they want to bring the BEE components on very, very soon as well, as far as that is concerned. But I think it's running quite well. From the 1st of April, it's mandatory for companies and who want to tender for government to go to the Central Supply Database. We supply our entire database. Every single data set that we have is applied into the Central Suppliers Database. And then SARS handles the issue around tax compliance. And this is another project that is working quite well currently in terms of the reduction of the burden. It's still new. We need to obviously build on it as it goes forward. We have people complaining about some of the information contained in the data sets. And basically, as we go along, we will clean it up and clear it up between the various entities. The one issue that's also assisting us very, very greatly, and I think it's also assisting SARS, and it goes back to the point of people supplying the same data to various entities and then not updating this data. For example, and it goes back to the point of for example, the example you use about addresses. People will go to SARS and they will update their address regarding their tax affairs, but they won't come to CIPC. I'm talking about a company. So we have different addresses. We will have one where the original registration was, and SARS will have one where the latest, which companies move, where the latest address is, or vice versa. We will have the latest and they won't have the latest. So when it comes to the issue of verification, the cleaning up of data, this collaboration works very, very well in the sense that we run the data sets between the various databases. We pick up the anomalies, Mark, as you recall. We had a whole session regarding the anomalies and how many we picked up, and then we clean it up so that as national government, we have one set of data and one set of sets that we can look to in order for us to do compliance exercises or to us to do verification as well as us to do the easing of the burden of these companies. So, Chair, that is just us in a nutshell. I think I was just basically picking up on the stuff that SARS has said, because SARS has put it in terms of the collaboration, what we've been doing as far as us going forward. That is very short. Thank you very much.
No, thank you very much, Advocate Foller, the Acting Commissioner of CRPC. Members, we have had the already, for those I know who have already indicated their apologies regarding flights, we've had the engagement with SARS, but there may be certain issues that have arisen consequently. So please, here is your opportunity for a comment or a question, because what we'd like to do now is to put this issue to bed, in inverted commas, as it were, So we want to be quite certain that all of the necessary clarifications are undertaken in this meeting. Honourable Mantashe, taking a by show of hands, any questions or comments? Honourable Mantashe.
I just want to check whether this collaboration is in place or are they trying to establish it?
I didn't get that, and I know it wasn't on the recording. Honourable Hill Lewis.
What is the timeline for the sharing of data among all of the entities such that there will only need to be one filing?
Yeah, Honourable Mantashe, we got yours. Yours was on mic, but the response wasn't. Thank you.
Honourable Hill Lewis, there is one issue regarding this, and I think Mr. King also picked it up. SARS has the issue of secrecy in their legislation. That poses a bit of an issue for the movements of some of the data that we actually want at CIPC. I think they try to get around it somewhat, in the sense that when there's a movement of financial data, they go back to the companies and they ask them a question, and they ask them a question of consent. Will you consent to the sharing of the data? That will do away with the legislative problem because they go out and they do it. And I think the last time we checked it was between 70 and 75%. What we need to now do is operationalize this issue to make sure that the annual financial statements that are now agreed to be shared actually move between us. They have not one has moved, all right? But that's just because of the fact that we haven't put a process in place in the back end to receive these. So when it comes to the issue of timelines, I think we need to obviously get together project teams to determine what the timelines are. We have got the interfaces already, so I don't think that it will take much too long to in order to do that. I don't want to commit myself to say 6 months because then I'll be out of that. But I think we need to just get together project teams. I know I'm the Lewis thing, you're going to come back and ask me 6 months about it. But I think we need to get together and then inform the committee in writing as to what our timelines are. I think that will be the best way.
That may have preempted a question. Mr. Kingham, did you have a response here?
Yes, I don't want to leave here saying that within a couple of months or 6 months even that there's definitely going to be something. The interface is there. It's a very robust interface already. So these are PDFs, in other words, a portable document format, so it shouldn't be difficult for us to send it through that pipe. I would have to come back with you to you in terms of what the commitment is. I don't have an agreement to say it will definitely be on day one or day 60, whatever it might be. We need to go and look at that. But we've done the necessary work already to make sure it does happen. In other words, the most important, getting permission from the taxpayer that we can share the data.
One moment, please. Right, back on track. Honourable Hill Lewis, Honourable Mantashe. Oh, sorry, I didn't see where the hand came from. Honourable Quirinoff.
Yes, no, well played. but I would like you to commit to a timeline, please, in writing, when you've assessed how, you know, what's reasonable and what's doable. It must be possible, but our committee has found that without certain deadlines, things tend to just drag on and on and on. So we would like to hold you to that.
So you're saying once SIPSI has assessed the acting commissioner, then we would like a response in writing on some estimate. Honourable Quirinoff?
Chairperson, thank you very much. Rule me out of order if I am. All of us sitting here has been FICA. You know, you go to the bank, if you do a small transaction, you must go through the laborious FICA process now, and it's getting worse by the day. Now, it's really hampering, you know, South Africans that cannot travel, you know, to certain institutions just to do it. So it is really becoming a problem. Now, what I've suggested to the Treasury or to Department of Finance, you know, you have serious FICA, and then you have just ordinary FICA, where all South Africans must just go through a process and put in where they live and put in whatever they should do an ID. Is it not possible when I do a SIPC registration or when I get my tax number that I can be FICA'd at that time and at least for a certain category of purposes for FICA, I will then be FICA'd and I get a number and I can give it to the lawyer if I sign for my bond, or I give it when I go to Lewis to buy something, I can give that number, they can look it up and they see I have been FICA'd. I don't know. I don't know whether it's possible, but you know, each of us is probably going through that process 3 or 4, 5 times a year, and it's every time the same process. Nobody is talking to each other. And you know, don't even talk when you're trying to figure out a company at a bank. It becomes basically, I won't say impossible, but very, very difficult.
From a CIPC perspective, they must speak from finance.
Yes, I agree. So now let's have the CIPC first advocate follow.
From a CIPC perspective, there's one aspect which we currently do on the recording of is that we FICA, and use of a better word, your identity. All right, so we've got a very robust interface with the Department of Home Affairs on two levels. One is if you go into our self-service terminals, we biometrically do it. And the other one is if you apply online, we do it via the data set. They give us the data, and then we cross-check it and reference it, and we basically see that you are, you say you are not 100% proof because you can change your picture and all of that. We receive certified IDs. So we know who you are. The one aspect of FICA that we don't know is the issue of addresses, because when you register a company, you don't have to supply proof of your address as a director. So that is the gap that is probably there in terms of what the banks will require or the FICA legislation will require, because we don't know that you live where you say you live as a director. And many directors, what they do is a lot of them put their addresses as the company address and stuff like that, even though in legislation it means we need your residential address. But that's the one aspect that we don't have. The other is that with our collaboration with the banks, and I find it really strange the comment that you've made, Honorable Gornoff, is that we have got such a good relationship with the banks that we give them real-time access to company data. So if you go into a company with a company registration, and it goes back to the point that Mark made, is that the taxpayer certificate is not worth the paper that it's written on or printed on, because people can Photoshop it. We say exactly the same thing about company registration documents. Anybody can Photoshop it. So we give the actual electronic data to the banks in real time with links to us, so that if they are confronted with the registration certificates, their branches can go online and verify it in real time, right, to say this is who you are, this is who is the registration, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I think the biggest issue that we have is that even though we have supplied the banks with this process and supplied them with the data, many of them have not rolled it out nationally. So you get a branch in Grahamstown who will phone through and say that we want to verify, or alternatively they just tell the client to go and get the document certified, for example, where it doesn't make any sense. We have discussed the issue with BASA, Banking Association of South Africa, on many, many occasions, and I have a quarterly meeting with the BASA head. And top of the agenda is the issue of the rolling out of the electronic services to the banks, which they have promised to do over time. I think it's getting better, but I don't think they've done it to all the branches nationally. So it should not take long at all. It should be, it's a real-time interface. They can do it there and then, and basically they can FICA a company when the registration document is given to them. But as to the individuals, I think from a company registration process, we have a bit of difficulty regarding the address. Maybe my colleagues from finance can assist.
Maybe to clarify, we're from SARS. We're not from the FIC. So I really think that we need to engage with the FIC in this regard. Obviously the way we can reduce admin is the key issue. We have exactly the same challenge in terms of our refunds. We want to know we're dealing with the right client, and it isn't easy. I mean, in the banking sector, you get what they call a whole series of what they call Exemption 17 accounts, which are accounts where the taxpayer doesn't need to go through a FICA process. And that is where we have some of our fraud happening, because so the person isn't validated. But I can't comment on your question.
it would be out of place for me to do, but I understand the reason and the rationale for your question.
I think, yes, that's a question that can go to our sister committee, Standing Committee on Finance, where perhaps it can be more effectively addressed, as that is directly part of its mandate, even though, of course, there's a bit of an overlap when it comes to our own area, and that is why we allow the question to move ahead. But as I see it, members, unless somebody wishes to raise any other comment or question, I have exhausted my clarification at this particular point, and I think that it was very constructive that you could both come. I think our next engagement, though, we do need to look at... I'm looking at... This is why I asked to get the program. It sounded as if you needed a couple of months. And I'm just making a comment, but I'd like to see a nodding or no. Yeah, definitely a couple of months. And that already would take us to the end of the year. Do you hear? So the earliest we could get, we could expect a response from, and perhaps then you could come here, would be next year. And perhaps that could be during the budget process. Am I right at that time? But if it comes sooner, you could email it to us, the response, in February, should you be ready at that particular point in time. But do take account of what has been raised about the NRCS and any other of the entities in the DTI stable that does have this crossover with yourself, SARS, you know, which I imagine is all of them for that matter. You know, not one exemption there. I mean, just about every DTI entity would be captured in that regard. So if we can get that, it's going to help us a lot more to ensure that we have that support and that relationship, which you have developed, RC, with the CRPC. That is quite clear. Thank you very much, then, Advocate Foller. Thank you, Mr. Kingon. And thank you, Mr. Murray, for being here this morning. But also to Mr. It was, you know, you don't often come here, Mr. Ramabulana. Thank you very much for being here this morning. Thank you. Now, just over to the committee. As you see, I had asked for the colloquium report to be here. We have spent in my office an hour or so trying to download what was emailed to us without any success. All hands were on deck, as it were, giving technical advice. Mr. Hermans can't even explain the challenge that we're experiencing. It is a technical challenge, and it's beyond our capacity to deal with. Is that not correct? So what I would like to do, though, is to give you a commitment, because the person concerned is returning today, Mr. Medema, that will be in your emails either this afternoon or early evening, number one. What would I like you to do with it? I would like you to read it through for the substantive issues. Identify those issues that were completely overlooked and note them. Remember, you've got the transcript, so it's not like you don't have the transcript. Have you got it, Advocate? All right. Look, it was distributed. I know there were one or two extra. We will deal with Mr. Whittington, and if you just remain a few minutes behind, we can sort that one out quickly. So you can all get the transcript, etc. Now, you do the substantive issue. The third thing you're going to deal with is, as you go through the substantive issues now, identify those issues you would prefer, you would like to see repeated in some form in the conclusion, either because they are generic or because they are so serious, you see, that they should be there. Then when it comes to the recommendations, The recommendations need to be under your party. Your name, yes, but under your party, as it were, as well. FUBS, ANC, or whatever. And we're going to be putting those in the different colors. You've seen the way we do that. So it's quite clear that this group was from here, even though the R2DA here, are they both in green or whatever. And the same with the ANC, the same with the Freedom Front, etc. And we will then have that in front of us tomorrow. Do you see that? We are not taking a decision tomorrow. You still have the chance to go back to your party to discuss this issue. But we are dealing with them. Do you follow? Page by page. And at that point, you will, on the end of Wednesday, we hope, Mr. Hermans, at that colloquium report, I know our own dynamics here, will then be emailed back to you up to the position we dealt with it on Wednesday. Do you follow? So you take that home with you, as it were. And as soon as we come back, there is a new program, largely because a lot of the legislation has been delayed until next year, because it is still in the processes of being at some legal office, perhaps. And that is Tuesday on the 11th of October. We are confirming this, but I understand that is the program for Parliament. And I'm looking at you, Mr. Hermans. Yes, the NEF. Then we move to the consideration of the first draft of the BRRR report. At which point, and some of you were here in the previous term, you will realize that we wouldn't have had a part of the NEF included, because we would have had them that day. But you will get that for the next lot, and it will be included. So that's the first consideration. And then the following week, I hope I'm correct, the formal, do you see? Now, when we say the formal consideration, I would have wanted your parties during the week of Tuesday the 11th to have had a chance before the 18th to consider that. You know, some of you say, I need to consult. All right? Consult, and then we can finalize the colloquium itself. And is that the, no, I mean the BRRR, rather. I was talking about the colloquium, though. When is that? So we'll also have that, the double right. So we'll have the consideration and then the final. Right. Then on the 18th, the 19th, we'll have the first briefing of the Performance Protection Bill. That is an opportunity for us to do some relaxing, as it were, because I understand after the briefing, we have the, it's been proposed that we do our oversight, go across to Stellenbosch Studios. Is that where it is? This is what we are looking at, so that we conduct our oversight while we are having this public hearing engagement. Do you see? So those of you who know of performers who really are living on tuppence, no recognition, the needlepoint, you know, royalties, etc., please let us have these names, because invariably you're talking of individuals here who don't have this protection. Do you follow? So we don't want to just see these record companies. We want to see the ones that are suffering, who are not getting this benefit. They actually personally, from their association, approached us 4 years ago and we couldn't do it. Now they're getting their own piece of legislation. You'll remember that, Advocate Alberts, do you remember? And we just couldn't factor them in. Now they've come back. And that includes all the local music. From, you know, the Afrikaans music to the Sotho and Zulu and Venda and Xhosa and everything. So now, there we are. That is what is proposed. Am I right? Then we'll come back. The other thing, though, is the Copyright Amendment Bill, which is not the same thing. I hope that's clear. No, but I'm just saying, right, it's just there, but we'll find out whether we're definitely getting that, but we've made space. The performers, you see, is a bill that has to be out. I just thought you should know that, that it is something. And then the special economic zones. That is your program that we will need you to adopt tomorrow, formally. All right. So please check it out with your party programs, and that, although we can't just for a single party decide that we're not going to have any meetings. I think that's the point. Yes, Honourable Hill Lewis.
I just wanted to add one other issue to consideration, Chair. You will have read, I'm sure everyone will have read, the very tragic and disturbing story of the death of 36 mental health patients in Gauteng last week. Many of them died in the care of NGOs who are funded by the National Lotteries Commission. And I wonder whether that is not something... I wonder whether that is not something that should interest this committee in terms of what follow-up the National Lotteries Commission does in, to check the quality of care delivered at those NGOs.
It did disturb me when I read that report and saw it on TV. It really did. And, yes, somehow it slipped by me, the National Lotteries. Honourable Hildur, thank you for bringing it to our attention. I think what we should just do is tomorrow, it's raised here, tomorrow to indicate that we are writing to them. Or do you want to propose that right now? Suppose we write to the National Lotteries. Let's make a formal proposal then. We're going to write to them, Honourable Hildur.
Yes, I think, Chair, if we can ask them two main questions. Two main questions. Which of the NGOs concerned were funded by the Lotteries Commission, and what mechanisms does the Commission have in place to ensure that NGOs that receive that funding actually deliver quality care?
Yeah. Well, what we'll also do on that issue, it may not necessarily have been quality care in all instances. It may have been a service, because we don't just want to put that there. We'll ask them that we would like them to come and brief the committee, yes, to respond, and then we, Mr. Hermans, you'll deal with the timing, but to ensure that it's in the first week of our return. Is that in order, Honourable Members? Yeah. All right. Just on that note, can you just, I just need to address Ms. McCarthy. No, we're not going to wait. This is the information I requested. At the time, we would have had the colloquium report. Now, because we haven't got it, doesn't mean to say we should sit here. But we do have to come back. We really do, members. We can't stand up an official delegation. So I am going to adjourn at this point, just adjourn, and I would like members back at 11:45. Are we all clear? Yes. Look, Honourable Hill Lewis, it's very important that this is the, what do they call them? The Westminster Parliamentarians, is that it? Yeah, the House of Commons. I think, Honourable Albert, you were here when we raised the issue. Yes. Because there are several things that they want to address, and it may well come up. Brexit issue, the trade issues, I don't know. All right, because this is trade and industry after all. So you'll be able to engage on the matter. Can we leave it there? The your housekeeping, please, can those of you who did not yet submit written apologies, written, and I don't know who you are offhand, and have not had the clearance or okay, whatever you want to call it, from your respective chief whip, do so by the end of tomorrow. Because tomorrow we're closing this quarter. And we want to then, Mr. Hermans, I'm going to ask you to show us on this list so we keep it quarter, you know, after each quarter, who was here and who wasn't. And then, members, you can raise the problem if there is a problem. I haven't had any water. Right, meeting adjourned.
Third one is once